believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight has the greatest resume I've ever seen. He produced the Jackie Robinson radio show, was the president of Bendix, was a professor at Harvard Business School, and was the CEO of McKinsey & Company. He was also White House staff director of the Carter administration. His name, Alonzo McDonald, and we're honored to have him as our guest tonight. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now, back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Al McDonald. Al, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure, Jack.
Can we start by you telling us about your childhood in Georgia?
Well, I was a child of the Depression from the Deep South. Those were tough days. I was born in 1928. So the first things I remember were as a young child in the early and mid-30s. And, you know, anyone who had a job was in a favored position, and anyone who could keep a job was considered to be a hero at that time.
Can you talk to us about your parents?
Well, my dad was an insurance agent and traveled back and forth to Atlanta to work. And my mother was a dedicated housewife, which was the custom in those days. She and my grandmother away for the winter, everything that we'd really need. And my father moved us out of town because he said things are going to be so tough in the years ahead. We better have a little farm so we can raise our own food, because otherwise, who knows what'll happen.
How old were you when you got running water in the house?
Oh, I was about 10 by that time. When we moved out to the country, why, of course, there was no running water. My brother and I would sit on the side of a big well and draw the bucket up. We had an old gourd that we would drink from to stay cool in the summertime, and then we'd pour one over our heads periodically as our form of country air conditioning. And it was one of my tasks to also clean up out of the outhouse periodically, because I was the oldest of four, and I admit that was not among my favorite chores.
From that very humble beginning, you've been with presidents, prime ministers, dictators, business leaders around the world. You've been in the greatest palaces of the world, the White House. Where did you get the dream to make these things happen and the courage?
I'm not sure that those really come from us, Jack. Sometimes those are gifts that we are given. I can remember early on, as probably a seven-year-old, I hired out to pick cotton one Saturday, and we were paid a penny a pound. And at the end of this long, hot day, I'd earned 19 cents. And when I came home, my mother said, "Now, what do you think about farming? And do you think that'll be your job for life?" And I said, "That is my last day on the farm. I'm out of here." And from then on, I had a great incentive to move to a different socioeconomic class, if that was absolutely possible. But anyway, the drive was there from the beginning.
Growing up in the Depression in very humble conditions, do you view that that was a help or a hindrance?
Oh, in my case, it was a help, because I had the determination to do something. Otherwise, it would have been very easy just to accept the circumstances, float with the rest of the group around me. And that's why I say it was truly a gift. When one has the opportunity to think on a broader scale and then to test the boundaries continually, I guess testing the boundaries has been one of the great delights of my life.
Do you think that's changed in today's times?
No, not at all. I think that one of the great gifts that we've all been given is free will and free choice. But that's within a range of circumstances. The circumstances are usually defined for us, and then we take a wide range of choices within that set of boundaries. But if we accept those boundaries, why, then we're condemned. And too many times we like to excuse ourselves by simply accepting the circumstances as our destiny. And our destiny is frequently much higher than that if we really push ourselves to the limit.
After you got out of school, you got to New York City. Mm-hmm. You worked on the Howdy Doody show, mm-hmm. and then you produced the Jackie Robinson radio show. Can you talk about that?
Well, he was a great guy. I learned a lot from Jackie. I was very fortunate. We got along very well together. We were both Georgians by native origin, and we had great trust and confidence in each other. And it was one of my great thrills as a young man. We didn't make much money in those days, not like you big guys today. But what I did get, I got free passes to Ebbets Field, Polo Grounds, and the Yankee Stadium. And since subways were a nickel at that time, if I could come up with really 20 cents for subways and 20 cents for Cokes, then I could have a date and go to any major league ball game in metropolitan New York. And that was not all bad for a young bachelor.
Can you talk about the role you played in the 1952 World Series?
Well, I encouraged Jackie submit himself to write a daily article, a syndicated column, and I agreed that I would be the ghostwriter. And so we would meet in the locker room after each of those games. I would ride out with my little typewriter in the back seat of his car. We would have dinner together with Rachel and with Jackie, and then I would call in my little story. And so Jackie was the first black professional ball player to ever have a syndicated column, and I was very proud of that. We ran in 124 newspapers around the country.
Even though you grew up in the segregated South, you were very open. Why?
Well, actually, I grew up, most of my playmates as youngsters were blacks. Until we got to school age and were separated, why, those were our primary friends, and they stayed friends. So we had, individually, we got along very well. We were caught in a set of cultural circumstances which were unfavorable for our continuing friendship, but individually, we got along extremely well.
What did you learn from Jackie Robinson?
I learned that it took not only a high competitive spirit, but also a considerable control, and frankly, somebody who would caution you against your extremes. I identified with Jackie very well because I, too, have a little bit of a competitive spirit. But his good wife, Rachel, calmed him down after the games. And I can remember being in that car and him saying, "Wait till tomorrow. I'm going to spike him coming around second, just like he did me today." And Ray would say, "I tell you what, Jackie, why don't you do me a favor tomorrow? Just get a single and steal one base."
We're talking to Al McDonald, and I'm Jack Krasula. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Al McDonald, the owner of the greatest resume in the world. You go to work for 20 years for McKinsey & Company. McKinsey is the creme de la creme of consulting companies. And in 1973, you become the managing partner worldwide of McKinsey. You were the head man at McKinsey. Can you talk about that?
Well, those were difficult days. Those were the time that OPEC, for the first time, was raising oil prices. Many of our clients were going into an unprofitable situation. Our predecessors had frequently been so-called experts about management, and we were moving into a new era in which the whole area of management consulting was in question. So those were not easy days. I was not chosen for popularity. I was chosen because it was a big job to do, and I guess I had a reputation of probably being nasty enough to do it.
They chose you and said your job was essentially a turnaround challenge, demanding measures, terminations, and disciplines that alienated a majority of your senior partners. That's basically what we're facing today. Oil prices, the big three, manufacturing firms, the world is turned upside down. What would you say to the people in those firms?
Well, first of all, they have my deepest sympathy because these are not easy days. And they're not days in which one builds a personal reputation for popularity. I had the distinction, unfortunately, of firing a partner a month for something like 3 years. And I changed more than half the office managers within my first year in that office. And so I had to take a lot of decisions about people, and I had to take a lot of decisions about what we did in individual offices. And those kind of situations are not fun. And most people do not even face up to them. They'll pass them on to their successor any way they can. But the reason I think I was chosen for that job is that I was considered to be a relatively hard-nosed but straightforward, relatively rational individual, and they were sure that I had the courage to do the work. And I did the job, and fortunately, at the end of that period, the firm ended up my last year in its most profitable, best balance sheet era that it had ever known. So I felt very good about it. So my partners were delighted to see their paychecks and their big bonuses that year. At the same time, they could anonymously vote against a continuation because they were concerned they might be next in line.
What would you say to the people, the retirees, that say, I worked 30, 35 years. It was promised to me. I put my time in. It's owed to me.
They have a legitimate complaint. Again, they have my greatest sympathy. I probably can be identified with that group as well. But a promise is nothing but an IOU. And a promise depends on the fact of a continuity of situations, circumstances, and viability. And we are in a totally new world of competition today. I've never seen it so tough as it is. It comes from all over the world, and it comes from very bright people. And therefore, I think it behooves all of us to think how we begin to look after ourselves more, because we cannot count on any single organization to do it. I can remember, as a matter of fact, out of my graduating group from the Harvard Business School, I would say at least 80% of our class have had as many as 4, 5, or 6 different jobs. There was almost no way you could stay with a single firm the whole length of time. And that's been a new era. And as our whole focus of our workforce has shifted from more manual and physical labor to more intellectual gray matter situation, while the whole nature of the industry and the whole nature of companies is changing. And it's a dramatic shift in terms of the impact on the population. And that's particularly important because we are now living longer.
When you left McKinsey, then you went into government. And you became assistant to President Carter and eventually the White House staff director. Mm-hmm. Your office was adjacent to the Oval Office. You were closer to the president than the vice president's office.
I was physically closer. I'm not sure that I was closer in other terms. But nevertheless, when he kicked on the wall next door, I knew he was angry. And I knew who it was who was kicking, because that was his private study. So I was readily available anytime he needed me. But I had good training for that job because he had named me just 2 years earlier to be the ambassador in charge of the delegation for the Tokyo round of trade negotiations in Geneva. So I had to negotiate with 99 other countries. And therefore, I was accustomed to dealing with a situation in which there was very little common interest. And I certainly found that to be true among cabinet officers and in members of the White House staff.
Many people feel that he was not a very effective or a good president, but that he is the best ex-president. What do you say to that?
Well, he's doing, after he left office, the same things he did when he was in office. But he was a victim of a set of situations at that time in which almost every day we had a new trauma. I happened to be there when the Iranian hostage was taken. I was in there the night when we were going for a rescue effort. And again, the president refused to continue with the mission when we lost too many helicopters. And he said, I didn't send people here to die. I sent them here to save others to live. And then we had a tragic accident after that. I was in there when nothing but difficulty was going on almost every day.
What did you learn from President Carter?
I learned that one has to accept the lot that they're given and absolutely do the best they can. And I also learned that there is an element of faith that may be important in one's life. And for me, that was a relatively new insight.
He was just in town in the last week or two with Habitat. What do you continue to learn from him as you talk to him?
Well, I find a consistency of a desire to serve. He is one of the most unselfish men that I know. He faced a situation that was almost impossible as president. I think he did the best he could, and I doubt if many people in that same position could have done better. When we were in office, I was totally loyal to him and his program. I felt good about where he was. He was conservative on economic subjects, and he was liberal on social ones, and I could identify with those very well.
Our guest tonight, L. MacDonald, truly believes that life is a series of chapters. This is what he lives. When we come back, we'll talk to him about this. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
We're with L. MacDonald. L, a little more than 3 years ago, I sold my business that I had built over 26 years. And you took me under your wing, and the advice that you gave me, the mentoring, was invaluable. One of the first things you said is, Jack, you've just finished a 26-year glorious chapter. Let it go. Don't look back. Now you have to come up with a new chapter. Different, but it can be just as glorious. This is a time to be, not to do. Very tough. Can you talk about how you view life as a series of chapters?
Well, I have a very low boredom level. So it suits my personality and my interest to keep moving, to keep looking at new things. And I also developed a philosophy early on that I could not feel sorry for myself, that sometimes they would go against me and I had to pick myself back up and start again. And so I developed an attitude of saying, I do not look backwards except to take lessons that I might apply. I focus on the present with one eye a little bit looking ahead. But I try to live every day because that's the only one we really get. And I've looked forward to each of the new chapters because I genuinely believe we each write our own autobiography. This is a personal attitude, but it's one that I thoroughly enjoy. And I think of it really as new chapters and new sets of excitement.
You, in a way, are the Larry Brown of the business world. In today's world, the only constant is change. Many people fear the unknown. They'll say, I can't change. I can't let go. What would you say to them?
Well, to me, life is a great experience, and I've always enjoyed new challenges. And I suspect I would not have had many of the jobs I've had, except that people that were wiser than I chose not to take them because they were too high risk. And that's the reason that all of them were not perfectly satisfying in the end. But it was with that focal point that I thoroughly started out the game and have enjoyed it all the way. And I still do. I'm not through yet.
What are your dreams going forward today?
I want to finish well. I want to finish this next series of chapters, however many I've given, in a way that's positive and I hope is constructive for my friends, my family, particularly my youngsters, and for now soon to be a dozen grandchildren.
When we come back, we'll talk to L. MacDonald about Confessions of a Wandering Soul. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. Once again, we're with L. MacDonald. L, for the last 20-plus years of your life, you've had a new focus. You've written a reading, a 35-page reading entitled Confessions of a Wandering Soul. Can you talk about the new focus?
Well, I spent most of my professional career with my own private gods. They were not the gods that one usually likes to claim, but they were the ones that many of us follow. Mine were money, power, and recognition. Other than that, I didn't feel much need. But I don't claim that I was at the top of the ladder, but I spent almost four decades trying to climb it. And I became very good at running over those broken rungs. I could grab on again and still scramble over those and make it to the next one. I don't claim that I got to the top of the ladder, but I was close enough in the White House to at least see where the top was in the minds of many people. And I saw that on the other side, all I could see was a great big black abyss based on what human beings could accomplish. And therefore, I began to think more seriously about what was the meaning of life and what were the values that I should probably begin to reconsider. And so I began to associate with people and to read and to think about things that would give me a new dimension, a spiritual dimension, which up until that point in time had been strictly tokenism.
Many, many times in this 35-page reading, you use the phrase, the Creator's hand. What do you mean by that?
Well, actually, it's a humbling experience to reach my stage of life and then to begin to look back. The great Danish philosopher Soren Kierkegaard said, "We look forward with hope, but we look backward with understanding." And that's exactly where I was. As I began to review what my life was like, and I had an unusual opportunity to do that because I came down with a surprise quadruple bypass heart operation. And that gave me not only considerable pain, but several weeks of recovery in which I could not do much except think and do a bit of reading and try to reflect on what had passed and why it had been there. And I finally decided that most of the things I had done were not really of my own doing, but they had been created through a set of circumstances that I happened to capitalize on. And I was an opportunist, if you would. But I finally concluded there was a guiding hand that had really directed me through this series of steps, and that there must be some purpose beyond my attempt at control. And I finally admitted that it was really through the careful guidance and love of my Creator that perhaps I had had many of these great experiences. I went back to the book of Isaiah, in which it basically said, "Lord, all that I've accomplished, you have done for me." And in my physical pain, and as I was trying to recover so that I could again walk and move around and begin to take some exercise and resume a normal life, I concluded that that was certainly the case in my own life.
By your own admission, you're a perfectionist. You're very, very strong-willed. I've had trouble, I've toiled with the phrase in the Our Father, "Thy will be done." Sometimes I say it, "My will be done." How have you tried to accept "Thy will be done"?
With kicking and screaming. It is not a natural set of circumstances for somebody with my personality and background, control-oriented as I was, one striving for perfection, trying to handle as much of my own destiny as I could, move in as many directions and exercise an excessive degree of ambition, I guess. But finally I concluded that it really was beyond my own power. And even though I still resent it at times, frankly, I recognize that that's where the real power lies. And to the degree that I can convince myself on a continual basis through a process of a repentance, because I'm one of the biggest sinners there ever was, I guess, I feel a certain personal sense of uplift, a sense of spiritual well-being that is truly a source of joy.
We're with L. MacDonald. In this reading, L., you say that your biggest sin was sloth.
Well, it was spiritual sloth. It was not the kind of sloth you think about in industry, because I didn't mind working 60, 70-hour weeks. I didn't mind traveling more than half-time, which I still do. I never mind the work aspect, but I did not spend much time in the spiritual arena. What I did was strictly tokenism, as I mentioned earlier. And therefore, I decided that I really had neglected the spiritual dimension of life. I had much to learn. I had much humility to begin to develop within my own life. And I had to begin to associate myself with people who had much greater faith than I had ever exhibited, and to learn from them as best I could. And that's been one of my priorities ever since.
Also in this reading, you say that your other two big passions were gluttony and lust.
Well, these are not items that I particularly want to brag about. But again, growing up in the Depression, when every meal was considered to be a treat, and when most of the food was either prepared or was grown right there on the home place, we were taught to clean every plate. And having lived in Europe for more than a decade, and having lived in France on and off for about 6 years at various kinds, and having four French grandsons, I have never been adverse to what was offered at the table or in the glass. And therefore, I've had to strive for a certain degree of moderation. But moderation for me is very difficult, because I agree with Oscar Wilde on the statement that the road to moderation is the road to excess. You never know what's enough until you've had too much. And so I've generally gone to too much, and then I've had to tread back. On lust, I admire all of the beauties that the Lord has created in the feminine sector of society. And I must admit, I still admire them, but hopefully more at a distance now.
For a long time, God was a junior partner at best. Now, you say that the spiritual journey is your number one priority, and that God is your senior partner.
Well, that's a tough one to make. I must admit that it is true that he was a junior partner. I would give discussion items and a tip my hat in that direction, but it strictly was a tip of the hat. It really didn't influence my thinking, my behavior very much. And since that time, I've been trying to think of how, in fact, the Lord or my Creator would want me to live, and what kind of an example for both my youngsters and my grandchildren that I could be. And I still did not hold myself up to be any kind of a model, either in career or in my spiritual life. I'm still struggling. But at least it's a conscientious struggle, and I hope to get closer along that line the longer I live, and hopefully the wiser I get.
You say that your main remaining ambition is to learn about and practice love. Not the romantic kind, but the kind where you're vulnerable, you forget about self, you don't want anything in return.
That is my biggest challenge, there's no doubt about it. I'm a professional, both as a negotiator and a business person, and the whole idea that one would give without a counterpartie is unfamiliar to my way of thinking, my training, or most of my career. And the whole concept of love, agape love, is to give without asking or expecting anything in return. And I still have struggle. I have struggled doing that. I recognize its validity, and I hope that I begin to show that more and more as time goes on, but it is not an easy road.
You end the reading by talking about your possessions are not that important to you. Can you talk about that?
Well, I've been fortunate to be not only blessed with experiences and friends from around the world, but also doing reasonably well materially. I'm not a wealthy person, but I've done more than average, and therefore I have accumulated enough to attempt to be relatively generous. And some years ago, as my wife and I began to think more spiritually, we decided that we had to consider ourselves not as the owners of these properties, but really as the trustees of them for our Creator. And so we began to devote more and more of our activity to gifts and to thinking about that. And I now spend about half of my time overseeing the activities of my small foundation.
We're talking to L. McDonald, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Al McDonald. Al, 15 years ago, you started another chapter with a couple of gentlemen, and this is the Trinity Forum Readings. Can you tell us about that?
Well, as I began to think more about my own spiritual life, I became interested in how I could reach out in some Christ-centered fashion to other secular leaders. Because frankly, most pastors and priests do not approach us to talk about our souls. They're interested in us chairing committees or increasing our contributions. But they certainly don't want to get into too much of a private discussion that might isolate us from what their main objectives are to get support. And therefore, I decided that it would be better for us as lay people to approach other lay people rather than working through actually clerics of one kind or another of any denomination. And so one of the things that we do is we, with a group of scholars, have put together a series of fora. And we do two-day forums for CEOs and high executives and their wives and government officials. And we do a number of those, and we'll do as many as 24 this year in Europe, just as an illustration. But one of the things that I've enjoyed most would be, are the Trinity Forum readings, and we do three of those a year, and I have the pleasure of writing either the introduction or the complete reading for year in each of these, so now 14 or 15 years. And so we perhaps publish as many as 5,000 of those for each one of these issues, and the whole purpose is to have some sort of an uplifting message that make people think, to sit back, to meditate, to reflect a little bit on the meaning of their lives and what at this stage of their leadership they should be doing to rebalance it or to strengthen the spiritual dimension in those lives.
You've done over 40, but can I throw out a couple titles?
Sure.
Two Old Men by Tolstoy.
Well, Tolstoy is one of my favorite authors, and this is a magnificent story of two men who decide they must make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem as a part of their spiritual journey. And the stories that they encounter will just turn your heartstrings as we begin to see some of our failings and some of our strengths with each one.
The Oak and the Calf by Solzhenitsyn.
Well, Solzhenitsyn is one who actually came close to developing his own spiritual faith in Christ in a cancer ward. And this begins to show how he acted as an oak when he was being budded by the calf of the Communist Party.
How Much Land Does a Man Need by Tolstoy.
Another great story in which is so typical of us to overextend ourselves and to take such risk in order to increase our rewards that we lose everything, in this case, his own life.
The Purchase of a Soul by Victor Hugo.
Well, this is a wonderful one in which some of the inadequacies of government prisons and the like is shown. But the generosity of a single bishop reaching out to a criminal touches the heartstring, and it really shows Victor Hugo's great talent for understanding human character.
The Sunflower by Simon Wiesenthal.
Well, this is an interesting one in which a Jewish prisoner was actually walking by a field of sunflowers outside of a German army hospital. And a nurse took him inside. And here was a young officer who said, "I need to ask forgiveness of someone." And Wiesenthal had to decide, would he give forgiveness? Could he give forgiveness or could he not? He refused. But the rest of his life, he worried about that decision.
Personally, Al, my favorite is Cry, The Beloved Country by Ellen Patton.
That's a great one. In fact, it's one of my favorite books of all time. It deals in that magnificent, almost poetic rhythm of South Africa, in which a learned black pastor of a church, a priest in an Anglican church, meets great disaster. And his neighbor, who was a white, illustrious landowner, also, both men have only sons. And by the strangest set of circumstances, one kills the other. And both men are absolutely heartbroken by this event. But through a series of circumstances, they find and reinforce each other. And it's a story of really true love under the most awkward situations. It was actually, in my view, written by the heart, not by the pen, by Alan Payton. It was written at night from hotel rooms When he was making a tour around Europe and the United States in the 1945-46 era in order to learn about prisons, because he was actually a reformatory superintendent for native boys in South Africa, and he was trying to learn how to do and treat them better. And this was his cry, if you would, because he could not see a solution to the South African problem. And unfortunately, he never lived to see one because he died in 1988.
For our listeners that are interested in any of these, if you go to thetrinityforum.org, you can get all the information. Once again, thetrinityforum.org. Recently, you did a CD where you went to New York City a year after the 9/11 calamity, and you spent 3-4 days with the firemen in the firehouse on East 29th Street, where they lost 9 men. Can you share that with us?
Well, I, as most Americans, I was touched by that. I lived in New York 4 times. This was one of my old neighborhood areas. I was touched by their great losses, and one of my friends actually had befriended some of them, and I had the opportunity to go in and spend 2 or 3 days with them and interview many of them. And I did a CD of my experiences with them because I wanted to see what the impact of that event had on them and their individual lives. I also wanted to reinforce my own understanding of what people were like who were performing that fantastic public service. As an old Marine, I was heartily encouraged by what I saw. These were extraordinarily dedicated individuals. They almost have what would be almost a spiritual calling of service to others. It was clear in our discussions that they considered themselves absolutely still to be in the prime bullseye of the target of the terrorist, even today. And they are people who go out in this particular fire station maybe 8, 10, 12 times during a shift. So they're always on call, and they never know when they'll come back. And many of them, in fact, have lost brothers, cousins, even fathers or grandfathers in the service of the fire department. And so I was touched by the humble nobility of these individuals for their dedication to their jobs. And I felt that we as a society need to recognize and honor them in the best way we could. And so I decided to do a series of speeches and CDs on what these people were like, how they thought, and how also it had reinforced their spiritual aspects of their lives. Many of them who had had very little sense of a spiritual dimension up to that point in time, all of a sudden realized their own mortality as they saw their colleagues pass away.
Can you talk a little bit about their love for their widows, for the widows of the lost fellow men?
Yeah, this was one of the most touching things because they assigned to each of the survivors and to the newcomers coming in the name of one of the widows in a family, and they essentially adopted them, and they brought them into the fire station. They would have parties for the youngsters. They would take up collection to help the kids through school. They would provide counsel for the widows and the others, and they, in fact, created what was the equivalent of a community club of support at a time of great need. And the closeness with which this group developed was one of congeniality and one of civic understanding and appreciation of the kind that I've rarely seen. One thinks that that would almost be a model of how one would hope that a society would evolve. Unfortunately, it takes frequently great tragedy for us to see something like this, but from that catastrophe, I begin to observe great courage as one of its byproducts and as one of its offshoots. And I was highly encouraged as an individual and as one seeking to reinforce my own faith to be with these individuals and to learn more about them and to spend time with them. It was my great privilege.
Al, I want to say thanks for coming. You're one of the people that I admire most in my life. The mentoring that you've given me the last several years has been priceless. So thanks for sharing your thoughts with all of us. Thanks for listening. Our guest next Sunday is a local person that made good. He's the president of the Baseball Hall of Fame. His name, Dale Petroski. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Thanks again for listening. Make it a great week. Spohn.